Welcome back. What is up, Internet Fitness family? Thanks for tuning in again. This is the Fitness Reborn podcast. Again, my name is Sean, your very illustrious host. My guest this morning is Phyllis Levitt. She is a retired psychotherapist. She's a speaker and author. She has currently written two books. The first one is A Light in the Darkness and Into the Fire. The second one, the one we're going to focus on the most here, is America in Therapy. New approach to hope and healing for a nation in crisis. Phyllis, thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's really, an honor and a pleasure to talk with you today.
Well, I'm glad to hear that because it's an honor and pleasure to talk to you. I really like talking to people, academics, well, everybody really, but people who come from a very long background of studying one thing in particular. So you've studied, you're a psychotherapist, so you've studied people mainly in all types of, in all kinds of dimensions here. So a lot of trauma, a lot of negative experiences, a lot of things that make people tick here. And I really like that because this podcast is all about people and what makes people tick, really. Mm-hmm. So, but before we go into like your book and your current background or your current work here, I like to kind of always kind of start at the beginning here where people really started. You know, I kind of like to start from zero here. So let's start with an early context. What was growing up for you and how that lead you into things like studying people, which, you know, is the most confounding thing in the world in so many ways. Like, you know, so much more in depth and complex than like studying even mathematics, you know, where you're just dealing with numbers and finite possibilities here, but people are not finite. They can't be pinned down very easily. So what got you on this road?
Yeah. I mean, and there's no one size fits all. So, you know, for people, so that makes it even more complex, but yeah, what got me on the road was my own life. Really. I grew up in a middle-class family and it kind of looked fine from the outside. And it wasn't really fine on the inside. And there was some abuse in my childhood, some sexual abuse in my childhood that really got buried for me. I totally buried it. And it really wreaked havoc on the rest of my life or my, you know, as I grew up, it wreaked havoc on my life because I felt like something was deeply wrong with me, but I didn't know what it was. And when I was growing up, nobody was talking psychology. Nobody talked about family dynamics or abuse. I mean, it was just a very, you know, kind of coming out of the world wars and the 50s and everything was like new appliances and good furniture. And, it, you know, it was sort of like what it looked like on the outside is what mattered. And so I tried to make myself look really good on the outside and I became a really good student. And, but to sort of speak to what you were saying about psychology and that whole world. So I was like trying to understand myself. That's where it began. And, you know, many years later, I sort of went a spiritual route. And that was wonderful in certain ways, you know, really trying to connect to a higher source of wisdom and power in myself. But it didn't heal what was going on with me. And eventually I ended up going to therapy when I was in my 30s and I had three children by then. And it just opened my eyes. You know, and I just began this healing journey of my own, and I began to remember what happened to me. And it was sort of a rough road. I think, you know, unearthing that level of pain can be difficult, but it's also, it's more gratifying than it is difficult because I began to make sense of myself. And I began to come out of the shroud of whatever that early experience was. And that's what made me decide to become a psychotherapist was having gone to therapy myself. It was just, it was really life-changing for me. And then if I can just segue really quickly, what I began to realize is that, you know, I had felt so alone in my own pain and kind of dysfunction. And what I realized is there's millions of people around the world who don't even have access to help. And they are a mystery to themselves. And they don't know why they make the choices that they do or behave the way they do. And so I began to see sort of like the global implications of my own journey. And that was sort of the basis of the current book that I wrote, is that I began to realize that we have a lot of dysfunction in this country. And through the years of all my years of being a psychotherapist, the level of pain and dysfunction in families in America is actually very high, even for people who look good on the outside. And I looked good to the world on the outside. I was functional. You know, I went to school. I got good grades. I was, you know, had a family. but there's a lot of pain in individuals in this world today and in our country. And I felt like I really needed to begin to speak to that on a broader level.
Did you? So it's interesting. I was thinking of someone else I knew when you were speaking about how you went through sexual abuse as a child and how you compensated for these rotten feelings that you had about yourself. Something, right. Someone else that I knew came to mind, because that sounded like a mirror image of her stories too, of her story too. Like on the outside, so perfect, you know, deadly in school, like getting all kinds of great grades, great scores, like just top of the class. And then years and years later, and sadly, that's where the great story really ends here, because in life after school, it was just like downhill after that. Well, I mean, post college, really. Mm-hmm. And then we come to find out later that there was all this horrific trauma in her early life, sexually based trauma that no one knew anything about. And it just kind of explained away everything that happened with everything. Like a substance abuse and all these bad relationships and all this kind of stuff. Like, because it was just, it was stupefying to us at the, you know, sitting on the outside looking in and watching her. It was like, what's going on here? This doesn't make any sense, you know? But then it did make sense to so many people, you know? And so when did you become aware that you had been sexually abused? Did you know about it when in your childhood, or was it something that came out in therapy as an adult?
No, it actually came out the first time I was in some kind of a class and we did a guided visualization. And I went into this place where I actually saw something abusive in my mind. And I thought, where did that come from? I mean, it was a shock to me. And we were told to, you know, draw what we had seen, and I drew it, and it was like, what the hell is this? And then it just began to unravel after that. And when I went to school into graduate school, I was in a hypnosis class. And so, you know, like so many classes in psychology, it's experiential. It's not just academic. You're not just reading about it. You're doing these techniques and these processes with each other. And when I was in the hypnosis class and it really all started to come out, and I went to therapy, I had already gone to therapy before, but I went to therapy again, and it all began to like unravel from there. Yeah.
Did you tell this to your family after that? You know?
I didn't tell it to my family for quite a long time. And like many people, that was hard. It was really hard. It was really hard for my family to accept. My parents have now passed away. They tried to listen. I think they did their best. And my sister and brother, I would just say, they probably really don't believe me, is what I would say, or they just can't deal. I don't really know. But it definitely put a wall between me and my siblings.
That's such a sadly common thing to say, you know. And again, going back to this person that I'm thinking of that I knew I just described, there was a lot of that too. That's really too bad. Because honestly, like again, from an outsider looking at, I can't think of any reason why you'd ever make up this stuff. What do you have to gain?
Well, you don't. You have nothing to gain. And I think it's a, you know, I think it's a sad thing in our society that we can't look at even perpetration through the lens of, okay, why did that happen? What are the root causes of abuse? what makes somebody abuse a child? You know, rather than like we vilify people so quickly when in fact most people who are perpetrators are also victims. Mm-hmm. And I talk about that a lot in my present book. And it's not that people aren't responsible for what they do. You know, if we hurt someone, we need to be responsible for that. But in order to interrupt that cycle of abuse, we really need to look at the causes and not just, you know, just in jail people or, you know, hate them because that doesn't help. It's, you know, I mean, one of the things I was researching when I wrote my present book, America in Therapy, is that, you know, more than 50% of incarcerated people in America today have unhealed child abuse.
Yeah.
And they're suffering. And, you know, I my husband and I were just watching part of a series by Oprah on mental health, and she interviews all kinds of people. And you can just see the background of abuse and neglect or unhealed trauma creates pain and dysfunction in people's lives. And that's what's missing from our national conversation. How do we heal? Not who do we hate?
Right. So what, okay, so going into the book, America in Therapy, what prompted you to write this book at this time? When it went, okay, first question is, when did you decide to write it?
Yeah, I actually had the idea for this book probably over 20 years ago. And I made notes to myself in these different notebooks, you know, but I never actually really wrote it. And then, I don't know, maybe 4 years ago, I can't remember now, I started writing and I wrote chapter after chapter after chapter. And long story really short, I got to the place where I didn't know how to make my chapters into a book. And I signed on with a really excellent professional editor and writing coach, and I rewrote the entire book from scratch. Wow. And that was maybe the hardest thing I've ever done, was rewrite this book from page one, but it was well worth it. And what made me write it was, and this is really the theme of the book and why it's called America in Therapy, is that everything that I've learned from my own history, from my own healing journey, from all the people that I've worked with over many, many years, you know, individual adults, families, couples, children, adolescents, everything that I've learned has shown me that our family dynamics have so much to do, and our conditioning in our families has so much to do with what we learn about how to cope as adults, and for better or for worse. And the more dysfunctional the family, the more abuse is in a family, the more neglect is in a family, the more likely we are to come out of our families and have a certain level of dysfunction and symptomology that is unhealed, that we then play out in our future relationships. And so the long story short of that is, institutions, places of business, schools, places of worship, we all operate still on our family dynamics in these larger group settings. And what I saw is that these family dynamics play out in countries. So in America, I call it the family of America, we have some dynamics playing out that are very injurious to people, that mirror abuse dynamics in families, targeting certain populations, blaming them for the abuse that we do to them, withholding resources from certain people, silencing truth tellers, silencing people who try to get help. We have so many of these dynamics going on in our country. And one of the big ones is, you know, that I think we see today that is very scary to me from a psychological point of view, is the investment in divisiveness, the investment in violence as somehow an answer to our perceived problems. When we know in families that these things not only don't work, they hurt people, they cause massive suffering, and they don't solve anything. And the whole point of psychology is to heal the divides, to heal the wounds, and to heal relationship. And I want to bring that to America. What we know about what heals trauma? What heals divisiveness? What heals violence? What heals hatred?
So you're talking about an investment in divisiveness, an investment in violence. So now I think, I mean, again, this is 2024. We're going into another presidential election.
Right.
We have another someone very interesting who is making another hard push for it, you know. And, well, we know how he got there in the first place. Let's just call him out, Donald Trump. And, you know, I don't like to go into politics too much on this show because I don't find it's relevant for the most part. But this, in this case, it is relevant because we're talking about, you know, nations and nation states and how they relate to one another. It kind of makes me wonder, though, like a lot of the divisiveness and a lot of the kind of like scrambling to hoard resources and to make one suffer over the other and try to take more and more for themselves over another to try to gain at someone else's expense. I mean, it's an act of trauma too. It's an act of trauma, but it's also just kind of like good old tribalism, isn't it? You know, is that, I mean, is that part of the traumatic effect, is that part of the cycle of trauma itself, or is it just like, you know, like I said, good old fashioned, one wants to conquer the other, and that's just kind of how people divide themselves and how they react to others who are not them.
Well, in some ways, you could say human beings have always been that way. That conquering has been and taking, you know, and being one up or ten up or whatever has been some element of our survival as animals, as creatures who are mortal on this earth, who need certain resources, you know, to survive. So yes, I think the impulse to conquer and divide and possess and control is part of our nature. And I think what we have to remember is two things. One is that cooperation is also part of our nature. Mm-hmm. Cooperation is an essential part of how we've survived. You know, keeping a family together, creating communities, and, you know, having defense mechanisms against wild animals or warring tribes, you know, whatever that is. So we've cooperated to create agriculture, to create better food sources and storage, we've created beautiful architecture and, you know, in this age, in art and in science. And these are ways that people have come together to survive better. And so we're sort of at this, I think we're at this critical place in human history where our impulse is to cooperate and create more and better for ourselves, which is wonderful. You know, modern medicine can do wonders for certain people. Our impulse to create and cooperate has sort of hit this place of impasse with our ability to destroy and our desire to destroy. And one of, you know, in order to conquer and possess and control. And one of the most obvious examples of that is that we have worked together to create weapons of mass destruction that could take life out on this planet as we know it. And so I think we're at this turning point where we have to look at the relationship of the part to the whole, and that is it sustainable for one person, one nation, one group, one sex, one religious organization, one whatever, one economic group to actually have that much power? Is it functional? Is it actually sustainable for all life, not just in America?
I think it's kind of funny. Like in the last few years, just kind of drawing back on my own memory, like say, like if we go back to 2008 when Barack Obama was running for president, and his whole message, the message he was selling was, of course, the hope and change, right? Like he was selling an idea. You know, an idea, this kind of, you know, we are all in this together. Let's pull each other up, that sort of thing. It was a very inspiring sort of message. And it did work. It worked twice, really, you know, and he stayed in office for two full terms. But then kind of came a backlash, right? Where you had people who were kind of rejecting the whole inspiring message, like we don't want to hear all this nonsense about this post-racial utopia that supposedly we're in or you're going to lead us to. And now it's more, it's less inspiring, and it's more like we're pissed off. We're angry. You know, we want to know that jobs are not getting sent to China. So it was kind of like a, just a real like angry backlash against this whole idea of like, because that's what he was really much selling, right? It was healing in a word. It was like, let's heal. Okay. Let's heal together. And then you had this, like a very vitriolic rejection of the idea of even healing. It's like, no, let's talk about something a bit more down to earth, right? For lack of a better term. As we're now talking, I'm just kind of thinking about that in that context here. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I have lots of thoughts on that. but you know, just to frame it, like I'm talking through the lens of psychology because I think it's the missing piece. I really think it's the missing piece. So we can talk healing, and I'm glad that we were talking healing, and I'd love it if we were talking healing more. But I think there's some principles of healing that really couldn't get in place in our political system. And I think that's part of what's missing. There are tools for healing. There are things that we have to change if we're going to heal. And what I stress, because I think this is the missing piece, is how do we actually heal broken relationships or ruptured relationships or deep animosities? How do we do that? And what are the tools that we could implement that we're learning to implement in our families today? That, and again, nothing is perfect. You know, as you were saying in the beginning, human beings are very complex. No two of us are the same. Our backgrounds don't necessarily produce the same results in all of us or the same coping mechanisms. So it's a complex idea, the whole idea of healing relationship. That being said, there are some principles of healing that we know work more or less to help people come down from their hatred, come down from their violence, and start to work together to heal relationship and make relationship safe and make relationship caring and make it nonviolent. So those are the principles of the best psychotherapy, some of them, that I'm hoping to bring to national conversation. So in answer to what you're saying, I think that we haven't even begun to implement some of the real deep tools of healing on a national level. And that's the conversation I hope to spark with my book, that actually is the missing piece. We're not going to ever, I don't think there's any going to be a war that ends all war unless it ends all of us. And we know in our offices that continued violence and hatred and vitriol, you know, just hurts people worse and makes them more symptomatic. So I think what we're looking at in our country today, and these are, you know, little mini bites of some of the bigger things that I like to talk about. I think what we're looking at is a lot of people feel very unheard, very disempowered. They can't earn a better wage. They can't get the medical care they need. They can't get the education they need. They can't get the housing they need. And they're looking for a strong man to identify with because of their own lack of power in their own lives. And this happens. This happens on the playground. You have one kid who's a bully who, you know, doesn't come by being a bully by accident. A kid becomes a bully because they feel unempowered. And they're looking to be the strong guy or to not feel their own vulnerability from their own conditioning. And then you have the kids who feel equally powerless, who identify with them, and they want to be part of the strongman group. And these are all different psychological dynamics that we could understand better in our country.
So how would you, okay, so let's kind of go into more of the meat of it. How would you implement this on a national dialogue? Because, you know, if even just in a one-on-one kind of relationship where you have someone in your office, I mean, you're talking about years and years and years and years of work. Right. And there's no guarantee that there's going to be a positive outcome on the other side of it.
That's
So
right.
how would we implement this on a national scale?
Well, one thing I want to say is that we have learned a lot. Is there more to learn? Probably yes. There probably always will be. But we have learned a lot about what sets people up either to become aggressive and violent or ultra-controlling and dominating themselves, and what sets other people up to be more passive and easily controlled. Okay, we do know a lot about that. I'm sorry, repeat your question.
it's just the question is just how would you implement this on a national scale? Because you're talking about, a nation of 400 million people.
Right.
And like we said at the top of the broadcast here, 400 individuals with individual minds, personalities, experiences.
Right.
And it's just like, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I think we start with education, and that is one of the main reasons why I wrote my book. There are many, but because I think the average person doesn't really understand the dynamics that are the result of continued traumatization of masses of people. And we're dealing with those in our country. We have huge populations that have been traumatized with no help, who are still being traumatized, and who we justify traumatizing. So I think we start with education. You know, what actually is the benefit of understanding our own psychology? When the very first session I went to as a client, the therapist, I don't remember what the therapist said, but I went to the library and I got out a book on psychology. And the first book I got out, the first thing it said is, our conditioning, our early experiences have everything to do with what's happening to us now. I didn't have that idea. I don't think a lot of Americans have that idea. I don't think people really, the average person knows that the way we're brought up, and that's in our families, in our communities, in our religious organizations, in our schools, in our businesses, and in our country, have everything to do with how we see the world and how we decide to cope or not cope, for better or for worse. And so one of the places I would start, and I talk about this also in my book, is, you know, one of the places we start in therapy is looking at our background, looking at our conditioning. What did we learn about our own values? You know, are the values of, you know, the right values for a human being? What did we learn about how conflict is addressed? What did we learn about the role models for women and men? What did we learn were the expectations of us? What did we learn about other people? All of these things we learned, and we each learned something different. And as a country, we also have a history. Where did we start? Who came here and populated this country? What did they bring with them? And, you know, so many of the people that came to America had massive unhealed trauma themselves and perpetrated massive trauma on the Native Americans and then re-perpetrated massive trauma on Black people. And that's just the tip of a big iceberg. So could we begin with like a deep dive into our own history as a country and rewrite our history books, not from who won the wars, but what started them and how could we heal them? So it's huge. It's huge.
Yeah, it is huge. It is huge. It almost seems too big to really kind of implement. I mean, I don't know. I'm not saying you're wrong here. I'm saying that trying to think about how you would actually bring this to on a national level here. I mean, you have, first of all, you gotta somehow get through to all these people who just like to reject anything that paints anything in a bad light. You know,
right.
You know, you try for so long. You talk about trauma on Native Americans, trauma on Black people. You try so hard. I've done this before. You've tried so hard to tell these people here, look, you know, it's easy to criticize how people are acting today. Look at where they come from. Look at the legacy in which they are born out of.
Right.
You know, one leads to another, leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. You try to draw a very simple picture in front of them, and they're just like, no, I don't buy it. You know, it's all about it's all about personal choices. You know, you made a choice to do this, and you did make choices to do that.
Right.
But, you know,
right.
And, you know, I'm kind of thinking wildly here, because it's interesting. I just watched a video. It was on Instagram. This company was called Actively Black. Speaking of blacks and trauma, Actively Black. It's athletic wear with like a black pride kind of tinge to it, right? And the owner made a video in response to a video of Tiger Woods, an early video of Tiger Woods when he was a kid, talking about the rejection and the hate and the negativity he got on golf courses and country clubs for being black, you know, and he's a kid talking about this from adults. And there was all this negative response to it from people, you know, saying Tiger Woods ain't black. And he was like, look, you know, he might have put a division wall between him and his blackness as an adult. But look at him in this video. He is a child. Look, you know, he's a child, and he's responding to how people are reacting to him as an outsider, as someone different from them.
Right.
It's only natural that you want to emphasize what makes you similar to them and de-emphasize what makes you different from them. And that bleeds over into adulthood, you know? And it's really kind of cool the way he phrases too. He also mentioned that he's in therapy. He learned about this stuff while he's in therapy, and he encouraged more blacks to go into therapy.
Wow.
That's what made me think of what you're talking about right now. But I'm just thinking the enormity of it all. Like, you start with education. Okay. So you start with education, you bring it up into the national consciousness. Where do you go from there?
Yeah, well, I think part of education is teaching people, helping people understand that there are tools we have in the world of psychology that aren't being used. It's sort of like if we knew a cure for cancer, but we didn't want to use it because it would interrupt the cycle of how much money people make from the medications they're selling, you know, and we don't have that. I'm making that up. But, using the tools of the best psychology to heal relationships on a larger level than the individual, you know, translating from the individual to the larger configurations of people, would require some massive changes on our part. But let me say this, because part of it is education, for sure. That's a beginning. That's a beginning. Just like for me, you know, when I first understood what psychology was about, it changed my life. Did it take away the work that I had to do individually on myself? No, you know, but it created a path through the wilderness for me that I could follow and that I did. And that was enormously life-changing for me. So we can be the role models of that for people that, and not that I'm not on a continual growth curve, because I am still in my life. But I think what I want to emphasize here is that what brings people to therapy? What brought me to therapy was unmitigated pain. My life was not working. I was in a terrible marriage. I was suffering as, you know, trying to figure out how to take care of my kids by myself and, you know, and go back to school and make a living and all those things. It was pain that brought me to therapy. And how much pain do we have to be in to be willing to look at another way? You know, I didn't go before that. When I was in college, I had a friend that suggested I go to therapy because I had shared some of my, you know, difficulty with him. And I went to one session and I felt so vulnerable and so exposed, I never went back. And it took, you know, several years later of like the pain really building to an intolerable level that had me decide to get help and to stick it out. And, you know, my hope is that we are feeling enough of that pain as a country, as women, as children, as men, as, you know, as poor people, as Black people, as, you know, as Native American people, as gay people, as whatever you want to talk about. My hope is that we can actually let ourselves feel enough of our pain to say, this whole system isn't working. This whole family system isn't working. And we are asking for change. We are looking to professionals who could help us steer in the direction of the changes that are life-giving and healing. And, you know, that's what I did in my own life. That's what thousands and thousands of people do today by going to therapy or going to other healing modalities. And so, you know, like, that's what I would say. Are we feeling enough pain? Have there been enough mass shootings that we understand that actually any of us could be shot in the grocery store? Any of us could be.
Yeah. There was a school shooting here in Iowa not that long ago. In a town that's maybe about 45 minutes to an hour. You know, a 17-year-old kid, I guess, was behind it. And he was 11. This is one kid that was killed. He was 11 years old.
Yeah, I read about that.
Right. Yeah. My son is going to be 10 this year.
Yeah.
I can't help but think, you know, when sending him to school, you know, is something like that going to happen? And these things tend to copycat themselves. You know, I remember school shootings when I was in school myself, and, you know, kind of think that thing might be in the past, but no, it just kind of comes back. But
right.
I
don't know about the 17-year-old in Iowa, but we do know that many of the people who commit these random shootings of innocent people are suffering major unhealed trauma, child abuse, sexual abuse, drug abuse, alienation because of racial prejudice, poverty. And could we refocus on, and this is my whole point, you know, could we refocus on what sets a person up to do that, that we could intervene first before they ever get to the place where they're so disconnected from other people, so disconnected from themselves, and so often suicidal as well as homicidal, because many shooters kill themselves.
Yeah.
That we could intervene on not only on the individual family level, but is our national family healthy? Is it contributing to the health and well-being of these young people or people who act out in these very, very violent ways? Could we take responsibility for that? Just like if a parent was abusing their kid and their kid went to school and, you know, beat up another kid on the playground, we would hope to intervene with the parents and not just the child. Right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So you have the education, you have the utilization of tools that can be used in a broad form.
Right.
So you basically just taken, you know, you have however many millions of people in this country who are in therapy on a regular basis, and just kind of like translating that into a broader platform, a broader context.
Right.
So what then after that? Like, how bad does it have to get? I mean, for anything to really make a turnaround here? Because like I said earlier, mm-hmm. we're going into another presidential election here. These presidential mm-hmm. elections, they tend to distract a lot more. You know,
totally.
They put certain key items in front of you. They have you focus on that, and they kind of make you blind to the personalities behind it, you know. So, yeah.
And blind to the dynamics behind it, because mm-hmm. the vitriol that is now a part of our presidential campaigns, it does nothing for anybody. It All doesn't right. put food on anybody's table. It doesn't give them a better house. It doesn't provide them better education or medical care or help for their family if there's addiction or violence or sexual abuse or what. It doesn't do anything for anybody. But it's sort of like, I call it the modern day Colosseum. We're just watching the gladiators try to kill each other. And it's great sport. And it's a terrible thing. It's a terrible, terrible thing. And so, yeah, do I think my book or my message, personally is going to change everything? No, I'm one drop in a big bucket, but I'm going to do what I can to try to change the narrative, to try to help people understand what's happening to them and what's being perpetrated and what can be done about it, not who to hate. My mission is not who to hate. My mission is how do we heal? And so one of the things I talk a lot in the second half of my book about what some of those healing elements are. And I'll just talk briefly about it here because it's, you know, it's a whole huge section of my book. But some of those healing elements really start with what can I be responsible for? If I'm having an argument with you, most people, myself included, grew up thinking the other person is wrong and I'm going to convince them that they're wrong. And hopefully they're going to see that I'm right. And I'm not going to give up until they do. But guess what? They feel the same way. Mm-hmm. And so nobody's listening. We're just trying to beat each other into some kind of submission that we're right and they're wrong, or what I want is more valuable than what you're doing, or whatever it is. We're very much in a win-lose paradigm in our individual relationships. And so, what some of the healing elements are is that we really learn to listen deeply to each other. Deeply means not only that I hear your point of view, but I start to hear where you've come from. You know, I've gone through this, and I'm married now for the second time. And when we have a disagreement, you know, it may be a bumpy ride for a little while. My husband thinks he's right. I think I'm right. And then we come to this place where we're really willing to listen to not only the other person's point of view, but where they're coming from. What are the wounds that set them up to be triggered by what I just did, or me to be triggered by what they just did? And we start to build empathy for each other. And because what we really want, what all people really want, is love and belonging. That's what we really want. And we get into these horrible arguments and fights, and sometimes people get into violence, as we know, and even suicide and murder, because those needs are not being met, because they feel so unvalued, because they feel like they don't belong anywhere, because they've been so mistreated or told that they're worthless. And so the bottom line of anything that I talk about, and, you know, and I could go into more detail about what some of those healing elements are, is how to restore love and connection, because that's what heals. And that's what ultimately prevents violence. And we're not talking about this on a national level. When people feel like they're cared for and they belong and they're valued and they're taught how to resolve conflict in nonviolent ways, they're safe. We become safe for each other. We don't want to go out and shoot up a school or exploit somebody or wage war. We don't.
It's also about turning off your internal dialogue. Is that right?
Say more about that.
Well, I mean, it's because you said, we don't listen. Mm-hmm. When, you know, we have a conversation, and I found myself doing this myself on this podcast. We have conversations. Someone else is talking. We're focusing on our responses.
Right. Totally.
Yeah.
We just do. Right.
Yeah. We just do. We're chomping at the bit to jump in here, interject here and
totally.
Say, this is what I think.
Right.
What about this? This is how I think things should go. And da, 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 da. I have caught myself quite a few times on this podcast.
Sure.
Trying, you know, ready to do just that. And I've brought myself back. Like, no, stop. You know, just listen. But that's about shutting off the internal dialogue, right? That is about restraining your impulses and actually listening to other people.
Oh, and you just said the key word, because I talk about six basic principles of how to repair a relationship. Mm-hmm. And it's not all that's involved, but I outline these six principles of repair. And the first one is restraint. Mm-hmm. And it's learning to tolerate our own distress and not interrupt and not threaten or not, you know, make a face like, yeah, sure, or walk out of the room or even just subtly with our body language, communicate that we're not listening. You know, it could be, I mean, I've seen everything in my office, and I've probably done some of these things myself in the past, but You know, I had one woman whose husband was talking about his pain in the relationship, and she literally pulled out her phone and started texting somebody.
Yeah.
You know, what a communication of, I'm not listening to you. So yeah, restraining ourselves from all the impulses that we have not to listen. Because, and I say this because I think this is such a valuable teaching that we all need. And I continue to need this. I mean, I can still get triggered by my husband. He can still get triggered by me, but we have some tools to come back and repair. And that's all that matters. None of us is going to be free from conflict or disagreement. I don't see that happening anytime soon. But what we can learn is how to repair the ruptures that we have in relationship. And the better we do that, and the more we do that, the less deep our conflicts go, and the less time they take up. You know, they're short and they're over because the beauty and the happiness of coming back into loving connection is worth it. It's worth that restraint that you're talking about. Exactly. Restraining our impulse to interrupt or, you know, tell the person they're full of crap or whatever we right. do. Yeah.
So you said that's one of the six key points is restraint. Yeah. What's the other five?
Yeah. So, and it begins with that. And that's how I say, I'm going to listen to you. I'm going to restrain. I mean, you probably know this from your own experience. I certainly do, where I'm just so hurt or so angry that it's really hard to restrain myself from interrupting, mm-hmm. you know, right. or doing whatever I do. But that's the first one. The second one is it's all about focusing on ourselves rather than projecting onto the other person, blaming the other person, demanding the other person change. It's so the second element is I reflect on myself. Where am I coming from in this disagreement? Did I actually behave in a way that I would like you to behave toward me? Did I listen to you the way that I want you to listen to me? Chances are I didn't. Because I'm in a reactive state. So I really reflect on myself. Where am I coming from? And then part and parcel of self-reflection is, can I take responsibility for what I see? Because usually if I'm really honest with myself, even if I have a legitimate complaint about you, you know, I didn't like the way you spoke to me, or you didn't call me when you said you would, and I was really upset. I thought maybe you had a car accident because I couldn't reach you. Whatever the issue is, it could be large or small. I can express a legitimate need or complaint or whatever about you, but I'm still taking responsibility for how I handle that. How am I saying that to you? Am I telling you, you know, am I you-ing you and making you feel like you're just a really bad person? Or am I saying, I'm really upset by what happened and I would like you to do this differently? This is a way I can take responsibility. Or I can take responsibility by saying, you know what? The thing that I said to you really wasn't very nice. I'm sorry that I said that. And that goes into the fourth element, which is, I call it rehabilitation, but it's rehabilitating ourselves. Maybe I'm at fault here, or maybe I could have handled myself differently, or maybe I could have just, like I said that differently to you. Or maybe when I, you know, turned like this when you were saying something I really didn't like, it let you know that I wasn't listening. I will really try not to do that when I'm upset with you. So I take more and more responsibility for who I'm being, even if I have, like I said, a legitimate complaint about you. And because what I'll tell you is that from my own experience and from my experience working with hundreds and hundreds of clients, that when one person does that, it opens the door for the other person to do it too. If I'm attacking and blaming you, most likely you're going to defend yourself. And attack and defense don't open up relationship or heal anything. They just usually produce more of themselves. And so, you know, when you see people get into terrible fights with each other, that's what's happening, attack and defense, and then attack back and more defense. And so the tools are helping break that cycle. So if I could be the person who doesn't go there, or you can be the person who doesn't go there, it's much more likely that I'm going to feel safe with you and follow suit. And I see that happening. So it's really rehabilitating myself. I can talk in a different tone of voice. I can make better eye contact with you. I can tell you that I disagree with what you're saying, or I don't see it the same way, without yelling at you or blaming you or shaming you. Shaming is a big one. The fifth and sixth elements are resolution and reconnection. So we resolve something. Sometimes just by deep listening, you've really heard me and I've really heard you. Sometimes the argument just disappears because we understand each other better. We're back in connection. The issue, which it often is between people, is something very minor, but it touched a deeper chord of some kind of wound. And so once we can share that with one another safely, the empathy grows and the desire for resolution grows. And it might be that I say, you know, I will really try hard not to raise my voice when I'm upset with you, because I know that that triggers you and I know it doesn't produce anything. And so that's part of the resolution. Or you tell me, you know, whatever, I promise to call you when I'm going to be late. And these are smaller issues. There are sometimes huge issues in relationships. Somebody had an affair, somebody's an addict, and they're acting out with drugs and alcohol. But these principles still apply. The focus is on who am I going to be that could provide the best access to resolution, because resolution leads to reconnection. And when we reconnect with each other, even if it's just part way to begin with, even if it's 10 days after the argument, that's how we come back into some kind of functionality and health and well-being with each other. And these elements can be applied to a nation. It might be much trickier, but, you know, one of the examples I always give is, what if we had trained facilitators in Congress? What if we asked for that? What if that was part of what we committed to, that actually facilitate this kind of respectful, restrained, self-responsible listening to people who have vastly different points of view and different agendas, and, you know, didn't allow people to say nasty things to each other, threaten each other, walk out, because first of all, it role models that for the country and all the young people in this country, and it doesn't solve anything. It just intensifies the battles that we see going on in Congress that don't help anyone, as far as I can see. So these things can be applied on a national level. Would it be an enormous 180 or 360 degree shift? Yes, it would. And I guess I would just come back to saying, are we in enough pain to want it?
I think if that did happen, the shift would be so great. I think that would actually threaten the existence of the nation state system itself.
I agree. I think that's true.
I think that would destroy borders. You know?
Well,
I mean, I don't say that as a negative thing. I say that as like, I think when I say destroy borders, yeah. I say that would, the entire nation state system itself, I think that would completely erode nationalism.
Well, tell me a little bit more about how you made that leap. I'm really fascinated
because when you started talking about, you had facilitators in government, in Congress, who facilitated healing and togetherness and oneness.
Yeah.
And if that translated into the entire American population, we're talking 400 right. million people. Okay. That's a powerful, is a powerful engine mm-hmm. that you've just created of healing and right. moving past trauma. And if that translated into geopolitical significance, how America related to another country, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Mexico, let's just say.
Right.
And so, and like you said, like if we became a model, not just to our own people, but to how we related to other countries, and if that model shines so bright that it just caught on from one to the other, to the other, to the other, to the other, we're talking a huge shift here. And then we're talking almost almost utopian in its implications here. It just went from one to another. That would erode the nation state system, because America, as you know, it would not function the way it normally does. Neither would Mexico. Neither would Brazil, you know. Neither would anybody, or Venezuela, you know, these countries that are typically at odds with one another. Because the idea would not be America first.
Right.
It would be people first.
That's right. That's exactly, you know, exactly right.
Yeah. Honestly,
that's exactly right.
Honestly, I think that would be Jimmy Carter's biggest dream right there.
Right? I think you actually got it. You got what I think we are facing. I think this is the challenge facing not only America, but the human race, that we are a very much me first kind of psychology still. Not everybody, for sure. A lot of the people that aren't in that psychology of me first don't make the headlines, but there are many people who are not in that mindset. But a lot of what is ruling us is that me first sort of narcissistic preoccupation with our own, you know, furtherance, that I think is a paradigm that is on its way out, and we're fighting really hard to keep it. Some people are fighting really hard to keep it for their own personal gain, but it's really on its way out. And I think that what we're really looking at in the great big picture is reworking the relationship of the part to the whole, the individual to the larger society, whether it's the family, the community, the gender, the race, the economic group, the country, or the globe. Because I think our ultimate sustainability, and I really think this as a human race, rests on making that change, that because this is what heals in families. One person doesn't just dominate with their needs. That's not a healthy family. Right? A healthy family has an ongoing, healthy, vital, and changing relationship of and dialogue between the individual and the individual's needs and the needs of a healthy family. And it's an ongoing, growing process. And that's what I believe we need in America and in the world, that because we see this heal families. When the dialogue opens and people are listening to each other, then you can factor in the needs of the entire family and the needs of the individual. Will every single need get met all the time? No. But then we learn to tolerate our distress, because sometimes my individual needs don't trump what's going on for the whole family. Yeah. If that makes sense.
It does. And even as we talk about it more, we sit here and think about it more, it's even more incredible in scope. And
it is.
You know, it's, no, I think it's a wonderful idea. So your book, you said before we broadcast it here, you said that it's not currently out, but it will be. So how could people... Right. How can people get access to it if they want?
Yeah, it's available for pre-order on all the major books. It's already up on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the major booksellers. So it can be ordered. It will actually be released in July of this year. And I would, you know, you and I'll just show you the cover because this is the cover. Does that show?
A little bit over to you.
Oh, a little farther. Right, there you go.
There we go. No, yeah, right. Great. That looks awesome.
Right, so that's the cover of my book, and I'm totally available to be contacted. My website is my name, Phyllis Levitt, and it's PhyllisLevitt.com, and I have lots of information about my book and about what I'm doing, and you can contact me. I'm really happy to converse or collaborate with anybody who's interested in what different application there are for these ideas, because, you know, sort of as our conversation went, they're massive and they're global and they're very individual. One person healing their own wounds and not becoming a blaming, shaming, aggressive, or easily exploited and dominated person has a ripple effect to everyone around them. Our own healing matters. And I think, you know, one of the many things that I think of when I wrote this book is that so many people today are saying, you know, it's too late for the human race. You know, we're probably just going to bomb each other into oblivion. And yeah, I'm just going to take care of myself the best I can until that happens.
Yeah. I have very little patience for doomsday predictions. Right.
But a lot of people feel that way because they don't understand that everything they do in their own life to heal and create better relations with the people around them, even if it's five people, matters. Everything matters. We have a ripple effect. Just like we know if one kid, like you were talking about Tiger Woods, is discriminated against and told horrible things about themselves or feels that they have no place in society, many of those kids go on to become violent, to become antisocial, to become addicts, to kill themselves, not because there's anything wrong with them, but because they haven't been treated well by other human beings. So you and I, if we treat the next person that we see on the street with loving kindness or interest or care, it might just be a smile. It makes a difference. We can all make a difference. And, you know, there's probably thousands and thousands of books out there of written by people who had horrible childhoods and horrible experiences. And one person helped turn their life around. One teacher, one coach, one therapist, one somebody who saw them and valued them. And it was the access to turning their life around. And we can all be that for each other.
Phyllis, we have a closing tradition on the podcast where I have the guests give last few parting words to the audience here. So you know, we cover a lot of ground. We talk about a lot. We go over a lot of things here. So if you could leave people one thing to remember and one thing only, I think you've done it actually a couple of times already. Mm-hmm. One thing. So maybe you can just choose one of those times to give the audience something to remember on the parting words. What would it be?
Yeah, I think it would be what I just said, really. Like we can all make a difference. So, you know, one of the things I guess I'll sort of put as a frame around that is mental illness and mental, you know, compromised mental health is not something that's about other people. Most of us have something in our mental health that could be enhanced or healed. Not that we're crazy people, you know, but that we've been hurt and that there's ways that our hurt is manifesting in our lives that's not particularly constructive, either for ourselves or the people around us. So there's no shame. It takes courage in asking for help and reaching out for healing. It takes courage. It takes strength to do the hard work of turning our own lives around and turning our relationships around. And it is worth it. It is worth it. Coming back into loving connection or safe, even just safe connection with other people, loving, caring, safe, valuing connection, nonviolent connection with other people is worth every bit of the work it takes, and more.
Phyllis, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me and being such a great conversationalist in this very big dialogue.
Yeah, not a problem. This was a real pleasure. It was very interesting to hear what you have to say, to hear your interpretations, and I wish you the very best of luck on your book. I hope it just blows up.
Thank you. Thank you. I do too.
Yeah. So I'll put connections to the website and to Amazon, Barnes and Nobles for people to pre-order the book if they want to. And again, the book is called America in Therapy, New Approach to Hope and Healing for a Nation in Crisis.
Yeah. And you can also find me on LinkedIn and YouTube. Yeah. I have lots of stuff up. So
for sure.
Thank you so much. I just really, really appreciate you and for giving me the time to share what matters so much to me.
Well, I appreciate you for coming on. And to all of you who have listened, all of you who ever will listen, thank you again. I'll see you next time. In the meantime, train hard. Peace out, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey, thanks so much for joining us. I hope you walk away with something useful from the episode. Don't forget that you can subscribe to my publishing platform called Samo Libs. It's the same platform. I upload all my episodes and I write my articles and my blogs and wherever else comes to mind I think is worth sharing with the world. The link is featured at the bottom of the show notes of every episode. By subscribing, you are becoming one of the very first that gets alerted whenever a new episode or a new blog or a new contribution piece becomes available on the platform. You can also follow the show, Fitness Reborn with Sean, by clicking the follow button on either Apple or Spotify or whatever your preferred streaming platform happens to be. I want you to know that your listenership, your viewership, and your continued support and your well-being mean the very world to me. Thank you so much. I hope to see you next time. Take care.